We should start by, I should start by saying I'm very happy to be here and to see you. I've always enjoyed coming to Portland, and so I'm delighted to be back. My life has been extremely hectic for the last month, so I have not prepared as well as I would have liked, but we will do what we can over the next 3 sessions. So I apologize in advance for not preparing as well as I should have. But that being said, I hope that we can have some good discussions, and I don't want it to all be me blabbing. I'd like to have some back and forth. So thank you all very much for coming tonight. And to get started, we ought to begin with the Vajradhara lineage prayer. O Dorje Chanden Delo Narodam Marva Mila Chidre Gambodha Tusum Chidre
Shara Tobin.
Sanjay Chidanj. We will be talking a bit about the 8 verses of Training the Mind by Geshe Longri Thamba, a great master of the Kadam school of Tibetan Buddhism. Kadam, the word ka means words. It's the honorific word for word. It means here the words of the Buddha. Dham means the advice or spiritual advice. So it's the lineage that makes all of the words of the Buddha into spiritual advice that we practice with the Kadam school. And Geshe Langri Thampa was an early and very somber. He was called the in Tibetan it said the black faced one, literally if you translate this is more like the scowling one. The scowling Geshe. Because he never smiled except some people say once in his life. Other people say 3 times from the time that he became a Buddhist. In any case, very few times. I am not like him. Sometimes people, especially these days, and some young Tibetans criticize Buddhism and they say, you can't have any fun as a Buddhist. You're too somber. People don't, relax. You just gotta relax. Instead, people are always thinking about suffering. Emptiness. So when you're always thinking about suffering and emptiness, then you're going to end up like that Geshe Langri Thampa who never smiled. Geshe Langri Thampa never smiling wasn't because he was personally suffering on his own behalf. It's because he was always so completely focused on the suffering of other sentient beings that, you know, he was always so focused on that. And that's from that that his pain that led to his scowling led. That led to the pain that led to his scowling. So it's not him thinking, "Oh, poor me," in scowling. It's always thinking, "Oh, all those other poor people." Mm-hmm. This is a very different type of. It's not the same as, you know, "Poor me." He's not, or "I'm angry at you. I'm scowling." It's like just seeing so clearly the suffering of other people and how unbearable. Of other beings, I should say, the suffering of all other beings, and being so difficult to bear it that he was really just only known to smile on one or three occasions mm-hmm. as a result of this. But this, when we talk about this, the pain that led to that scowl, this is not pain for the self. It's the pain that is entwined with compassion. So as a result of that, looking at other people, instead of saying, "Poor me, I can't do anything," it's actually a question of that motivated him, made him even more committed to the path and to practicing the teachings of mind training. So this is the scowling. You know, we talk about the happy yogi. We all want to hear about the happy yogi. Well, this is not the happy yogi. The scowling one. The way that, of course, these eight verses of training the mind, we talk about mind training. And the most famous text of mind training is the one you have the cards right back here. From the 7 points of mind training by Cha Chikawa Yeshu Dorje. So we say mind training, like, oh good, Tonglen meditation. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, actually, Tonglen meditation is not taught directly in this. Rather, what these eight verses teach are like the basis of the reasons why, very briefly and through a lot of examples. Like the first seven verses are really talking about the first six verses. Are teaching the reasons why through examples. And then the seventh verse is teaching about the actual practice of Tonglen meditation very briefly. And then the eighth verse is teaching about how we should be free of any conceptual constructs of this. Or you could also look at this as seven verses teaching relative bodhicitta and one verse teaching ultimate bodhicitta. So when we look at this, well, first of all, with Geshe Langri Tampo, maybe we don't necessarily need to take the example of being so stern and scowling all the time, but we do need to think about if we can train our minds to the extent that he and the other great masters of the Kadam tradition did. And when we think about, you know, bodhicitta, okay, well, what is bodhicitta? We're training our mind in bodhicitta. Well, what is this bodhicitta that we have to train our minds in? And we can say, oh, it's very easy, yes. Bodhicitta is compassion. Well, maybe. Bodhicitta comes out of compassion, but it's a little bit different. Well, then, so, okay, then you look in the texts, and the texts will say, bodhicitta is the wish to achieve Buddhahood for the benefit of all sentient beings. Well, okay. Why should we attain Buddhahood? Why for the sake of all other sentient beings? And so this is why, one of the reasons why thinking about these verses of training the mind is so important, is because they give us some of the reasons why it's so important to think about training the mind in bodhicitta. So, well, we want to achieve Buddhahood. Well, what is Buddhahood? Is the first question. And the basic answer for that question is It's a state of happiness. But if we think about, well, we're happy sometimes. Yeah, we've got some moments. Pretty comfortable. Maybe you're pretty happy a lot of the time. But how long does this happiness last? So is that good enough? It lasts for a while, but not all that long. I mean, especially on a cosmic terms. Like when Rinpoche teaches about this, he talks about happiness. Well, you can be happy, he always says, for 10 years, 100 years, 1,000 years, 10,000 years. And so, well, we sort of think, well, 100 years isn't so bad. And then 1,000 years, how can you be happy for 1,000 years or 10,000 years? Well, that's clearly not within the confines of a human life. A human life may be a few years, if you're lucky. That's sort of looking at a longer term of samsara. But when we're talking about Buddhahood, we're talking about a lasting state of happiness, a state of happiness that doesn't end, and comfort. It's like once someone asked Rinpoche, what do we mean by a state of happiness? And he said, well, the absence of suffering. So there's nothing to bother, nothing can really get at you, nothing causes you any pain or suffering. That doesn't mean that things don't happen, but they don't actually get you. And this, the reason for this is that it's real. It's a state of mind that doesn't depend upon any causes or conditions, so it's a lasting state of happiness. So, well, if we're going to bring all sentient beings happiness, what sort of happiness should we bring them? If we bring them temporary happiness, that's good. It's like a meal or clothing or whatever, like through the normal generosity that a lot of people, even non-Buddhists, perhaps even more so than Buddhists sometimes, mm-hmm. helping people with food and clothing and so forth. It's wonderful. It's very good. It might bring them some happiness. I gave a beggar in Nepal. I didn't have any 10-rupee notes. I gave him 100-rupee notes. He was very happy. Later the day, I saw him staggering around. He had gone off and gotten himself drunk. So you can't deal with it. What are people going to do? You don't give her you're stingy, you give him 100 rupees and he goes off and he gets drunk. He was very happy for a very short time. whether that was intelligent on my part or not is a different question, whether it was helpful or not. But the question is, he was happy and very thankful and effusive about it. Then what happened the next day? He was back to his normal sort of leprous state. So it didn't last very long. So was it good? We can debate that. If you give someone a hot meal who needs a hot meal, that's good. Let's not bring about something that, you feed the homeless for a day. Wonderful. But that day, that full stomach will last for a few hours before they get hungry. So what can we do to bring all sentient beings to a state of lasting happiness? Well, the only way we can do that is by bringing them to Buddhahood. And in order to bring them to Buddhahood, well, that requires that we also come to Buddhahood first, because if you don't know the way, you can't get there. And you only can really figure out the way by doing it yourself. So that's good. And so we think, oh yeah, well, I want to do that. But often we leave it at that. Yeah, we should have bodhicitta. I'm going to do what it takes to become a Buddha in the next life or a future life. I'll take my time about it. It takes 3 innumerable eons. It's a long time. I've got some time to worry about it. Well, if we start thinking like this, we might think, well, I can't really do it. It's more important to do this or that. It's more important to, I got to have my morning coffee before I meditate. And then, you spend so much time making coffee that you have only 5 minutes left in your meditation period before you're supposed to go back to go off to work or whatever. Or anything. There are various things that get in our way that keep us from actually doing. I'm using examples from, sort of your lives, but it's also me. Frankly, it's like, oh, I got up too late today. And I've got to get this project done. I haven't got time to do my morning meditation. I'll do the quick version. So it's a problem that affects many practitioners. And the question is, what do we do about this problem? How do we actually come to the point where we really want to bring people to Buddhahood? Well, I think one of the first things we have to do is we have to actually, this is not said in this text, it's said in the text by Chajikawa Isha Dorje, first train in the preliminaries. And so it does not say this in this text. This is a text that's teaching the Mahayana view of bodhicitta. Well, if you're going to teach bodhicitta, then if you're going to think about having bodhicitta, then you actually first have to have a sense of that suffering, that samsara is suffering, and that you want to get out of suffering yourself. You and other people are like you. They also want to avoid the suffering. And if you don't have that basic sense of that it comes from the preliminaries, then forget about bodhicitta. When you're practicing the Dharma, what makes the Dharma the Mahayana Dharma is not the fact, oh yeah, we're doing Tonglen meditation. You can do Tonglen meditation all you want, but if you don't actually have the Mahayana motivation, it's not actually Mahayana Dharma. Because for you could be doing it with the motivation similar to the Theravada tradition. They do the meditations on, they call it metta. In Sanskrit, it's in Maitri, but metta, it's a wonderful meditation, very helpful, very beneficial. They do a lot of compassion meditation. They do it primarily in the Thai and the and a lot of other traditions. You know, they do it primarily to get freedom from samsara for themselves. Now, if it helps other sentient beings, that's great, but it's not their primary focus. Their primary focus is to achieve nirvana. And then we come over to here, into this country, and our primary motivation for doing Tonglen or for doing metta meditation is like, ah, you'll feel much more peaceful. Mm-hmm. You know, stress reduction. And so when we are doing Dharma for the sake of stress reduction, it's good. It's wonderful, actually. It's important for a lot of people in the context of our busy lives. But and it does plant the seeds for future, but it might be a long time in the future. And who knows what's going to happen in between now and then. I think a lot of us don't even have a lot of confidence that anything is going to come after this life or that we know anything about it, which on the one hand is a reasonable stance. So if we have this attitude of essentially we're doing Tonglen meditation because we'll feel better now, or we'll do Mahamudra meditation because we'll do now, because we'll develop a new experience of our bodies, we'll develop a new experience of our minds, well, this is all very good. Well and good, but we wouldn't be really training the mind in the way that these verses of training the mind talk about. And so the first thing we need to do is we need to actually, before we do anything else, we have to do what Chajikawa Isha Dorje says, and first train in the preliminaries. And the preliminaries are the four thoughts that turn the mind, which I think, looking out at all of you, I think most of you have heard of these four thoughts that turn the mind. And when I did my Ngundro starting in 1999 or 2000, whenever it was, yeah, four thoughts that turn the mind, great. Oh yeah, Pato Rinpoche has really got an inspiring description of them. That's great. Oh yeah, Jamgon Kontrol, he's pretty good too. Pato Rinpoche, he's really inspiring. That's great. I'm going to start my prostrations. So I skipped them. I thought I hadn't skipped them, but I did. And, you know, it's very easy to do it because you say, oh, yeah, we're going to do the preliminary practice. We have to do 100,000 prostrations. Yeah, we have to go for refuge. We have to do this. But we haven't done the very first step. In the three-year retreat center, three-year retreat traditionally start out with the preliminaries. So you start out by meditating on the precious human life for a week. That's from 4 a.m. until about 9 p.m. And then you meditate upon impermanence for a week. And then you meditate upon the defects of samsara for a week. And you meditate upon, oh, sorry, you meditate on karmic cause and effect for a week. And then you meditate upon, what is it? The defects of samsara. So the four, they spend a week meditating upon each of them. And then you, that's, you know, so you've been there a month. And there's not a whole lot of instruction about these. You just have to sit and think about them. Well, there's a lot of instructions about them, but you really have to just think about them. So we skip over them really quickly. We get an idea about them. We think we know, but do we really take it to heart? And so as a result, it's difficult for us to see the pleasurable things in our life as being the suffering of change. It's difficult for us to see that, let alone to see that for other people. And even to the point of thinking, I've got to get out of this. We've got to start out with this sense of, I mean, first you have to have the sense that you want to help yourself and others. Then you have to have the sense that I want to and I can get out of this. This is what we call, in English, it's usually translated as renunciation. The actual Tibetan word, Ngejungi Sampa, means the intent upon emancipation. So you want to free yourself. It's sort of the English is looking at one aspect, Tibetan is looking at another aspect. I'm not sure I'm going to say that renunciation is a bad translation, but to understand it, the wish for emancipation is a little bit awkward sometimes. But really, that's what we're talking about. So you have to have the sense that you want to, really, really, really want to emancipate yourself. Because if you don't want to emancipate yourself from suffering, forget about emancipating other people. So in this sense, this is what Trungpa Rinpoche would talk about. It's on, you know, we have to have this Hinayana thought before we can develop the Mahayana. So you first train in the Hinayana, then you train in the Mahayana. Well, it's this is what Dzogchen Khantro Lhotse Thay Rinpoche says, that if you're going to have bodhicitta, you have to have renunciation. You have to have the wish for emancipation first. So what I wanted to start out was, talking about a little bit about these preliminaries tonight, and then tomorrow morning we'll start with the eight verses for training the mind by Geshe Langri Tampa. So the four thoughts that turn the mind, and actually of the four thoughts, I really want to talk about the second of them. The first thought is the precious human body. And the precious human body is the fact that we are here. We are born humans. We have a certain amount of leisure and free time in our lives. We are able to practice the Dharma, and we have the interest in practicing the Dharma. And this is incredibly rare, no matter how you look at it. They talk about it traditionally in terms of analogies, in terms of numbers, in terms of mainly in terms of analogy and numbers and in reasoning. But, you know, you can think about it. How many animals out there? There are the ones that we can see, the birds and the bugs, and then there are all those in the ocean. So we could have been born, if we were going to take birth on this earth, just numerically, statistically, what is the chance that you're going to be born human compared to that? It's said there's an article on methane production that I read 20 years ago. Said that there is a termite hill in Africa for every single human being on this planet. A hill full of millions of burping termites who emit methane gas. That was the context of the article, but this is so we think about it. Well, there's a termite hill with your name on it. Or if you think about krill in the ocean, here in Maine, I can make maritime analogies. So, how many krill does it take to fill the stomach of a blue whale? You know, billions upon billions of them over the course of a blue whale's lifetime. Probably thousands with every given mouthful. And then actually, I was also reading something the other day there that said, I don't know how true this is. Those of you with any medical knowledge can correct me if this is wrong. There are 10 parasites in our body for every single cell, it said. So I don't know if this is true or not, but at any rate, even if there's only a 1-to-1 ratio. And whether they're sentient or not is something that's beyond my ken. The Buddha did say that we have 84,000 kinds of beings, dwelling within our body. So that implies a bit of sentience. So at least some of them are sentient. So what is the chances that we would have been born a paramecium or an amoeba or something else? As opposed to a human, if you look at that, there may be 7 billion humans on the planet, but if there are, 10 microorganisms for every cell in each of those humans' bodies, there are exponentially more microorganisms. And then when you talk about the other lower realms that are mentioned in the Buddhist texts, they're said to be even more numerous than the animals. The hell realms, the most numerous of them all. And so having a human body is one thing. Well, okay, you might think though, but there are more and more humans on the planet every single year. 7 billion and counting, 10 billion by 20 something. I don't remember the last report that I read about. And maybe there are 8 billion by now, for all I know. There are more and more humans, millions of babies being born every single day. So you might think, well, a human body isn't so precious. There are 7 billion of them. Well, there is a human body, and then there's our normal, that's the normal human body, and then there's the precious human body, the one where we have the opportunity to actually practice the Dharma. And so how many is that? If we look in the United States, it's nice to be back in the United States. I can use United States metaphors again and have people understand them. So if you think about the human beings in the United States who practice Buddhism, well, there are a couple million, 3 million maybe, something like that. And that depends on which survey you read. And so if there are 3 million, that's about 1% of the population of the United States. And how many of those Buddhists are actually cultural Buddhists who are fortunate to be Buddhist and have that cultural connection but don't really practice themselves? This would be like members of the Vietnamese communities or some of the members of the Chinese community. Actually, quite a lot of them take the Dharma very seriously, but there are many who don't, who just sort of think, oh yeah, I'm Buddhist because I was born Buddhist, but they don't really practice it. So to have a situation, or we can take a look in Portland. There are about, what, 30 members here. There are a bunch of other Dharma centers, many of which probably have 30, 40, so you've got a few hundred members of Dharma centers in a city of 200,000 people. Is it 250?
60.
Okay, you know the numbers better than me. At any rate, if you do the math, it is a fraction of 1%. So it's a very small number of people who have the opportunity to actually practice the Dharma. And so we're among those people. And so when you start, if we just think about it, we're talking about it tonight. Yeah, makes sense. Great. Yeah, I'm pretty fortunate. Then you leave it at that. Then it's good to have thought it, but it's maybe not so beneficial. Or not as beneficial as it could be. And then the second one is the one that I really want to talk about, the impermanence. And I know that a lot of you here have aging parents or parents who have recently passed away. A situation that, this is a very common situation for people of our age group, give or take, 10, 20 years, or maybe your parents have been have passed away many years ago, but you are getting closer to your own and started thinking about your own mortality more. And this is, I think, actually, it's a really great opportunity for us not always the easiest opportunity, but it's a really wonderful opportunity. When we meditate upon impermanence, there are two ways we can do it. We can think about the things that it says in the texts, and then we can look at what's actually going on in our lives. And of the two, actually it's best to kind of mix the two. Do a little bit of one and then a lot of the other. So we'll start with a little bit of the one, which is what's talked about in the texts. So there are five Kadampa sayings about impermanence. And the first of these is, reflect that nothing lasts, everything changes. The first of the five. These are in The Torch of True Meaning by Chamgon Kontra Lodra Thay Rinpoche. You know it as The Torch of Certainty, perhaps. The Torch of True Meaning is a little bit more literal title. And so the first of the five Kadampa sayings is that nothing lasts, everything changes. So you just have to look. Actually, this is, you can combine this. You go to, what's the name of that place? It begins with an A, the coffee shop up on Congress. No, not Congress, just down from Congress Street.
Arabica.
Arabica. Thank you. In other cities, I would say Starbucks. Here, I'll say Arabica. You go to Arabica, and you get yourself your mochaccino or your latte or whatever. And it's hot. If you let it sit, it gets cold. The longer you let it sit, the worse it gets. it may be very good coffee at the very beginning. At the beginning, it actually might be even good when it's kind of cold. But if you let it sit long enough, what is going to happen to it? It's going to turn green. Well, maybe not coffee, but but you know, it's not going to be any good. You can just look if you that jar in the back of your refrigerator. It was mayonnaise. It was a decent jar of mayonnaise. And now what is it? You don't want to know. It's a science experiment. Or that lemon that's sitting back there, you know. So you can look. Everything is changing. Everything, nothing lasts. Your moods, they change. Everything else, the weather. So you can look at it. Everything is always changing. And the second of the five Kadampa sayings is that contemplate the many others who have died. So it says in Jamgon Kondro Lodra Thay's commentary that think of the many others who have died. They're more numerous than the people that you know. And I think perhaps when you get to a certain, in this culture, when you get to a certain age, that is so. I remember my grandmother in the last years of her life, everyone else had died. And she, you know, basically she was one of a handful left. Maybe your parents are talking about the same thing, or you might remember your grandparents talk about that. For people who are in their in the primes of their lives, or in the new middle age, this may not be so true. But the time that Jamgon Kontra Rinpoche was teaching this, it was very true, because people were born into large families, 10 children, 5 of them died, and then a lot of people were killed in the prime of life, healthy young people killed by an avalanche or whatever, being in Tibet. So, and it's probably the same back in, not too long ago, in this country as well, you know, before antibiotics and so forth. So we're very fortunate that we don't know so many people who have died and don't have a lot of contact with people of our own age who have died. Although I think every one of us probably knows a few. So you have to think about them. You know, it's not just sort of leaving it there, oh yeah, a lot of people have died. Yeah, so what? Well, they've died, and are you going to escape it yourself? And so it's a question of really sitting and thinking about it. And then you contemplate the many causes of death again and again. That's the third slogan. Just crossing the street. You know, we can be a little bit glib about it. Yeah, walking across the street, you don't even know. I don't feel like I need to get too too heavy about this, but you know, you can think about it. There are lots of, even the things that sustain life can become the cause of death under certain conditions. And the fact that we have avoided them as long as we have is a sign of great merit for being born in a society like this, for, on the one hand, and also just incredible luck. I think someone rescued me the other day. They stopped me from walking out in front of a car in Hong Kong a couple weeks ago. I'm not sure if I was going to walk in front of the car or not, but they thought I was going to. And so thank you. So, you know, but that sort of thing is very common, and there are many other ways that we could die at any time. So we should contemplate those over again, and then contemplate what will happen at the time of death. Thinking about the physical process of dying and what happens. You know, you're going to go alone. You can't bring anything with you. There's nothing you can. There comes a certain point where you can't stop it, and you can't bring your friends and your family. All of them. You may be surrounded by loved ones at the moment of your death, but none of them can come along with you. You can't bring your favorite things. Your pet will not accompany you. None of that will be much help at that time of death. There's only one thing that will be helpful at the time of death, and that's what you have done with your mind in this life. And then contemplate what happens after death. So, if we're materialist, I don't know how many of you, do you have any strident materialists who come anyways? There are a few materialist Buddhists, atheist Buddhists, who say there's nothing afterwards. I think Rinpoche, and actually His Holiness the Dalai Lama as well, they have a good take on it. We cannot prove one way or the other. So, I'm sure you've heard this before. If we can't prove it one way or the other, if you prepare for this life, if you prepare as if there are future lives and train as if there are future lives, so you get to the moment of death, 50% nothing, 50% something. Okay, nothing, haven't lost anything. In fact, you've gained because it's been helpful in this life, the stress reduction. Okay, the 50%, something's going to happen. You haven't prepared in this life, you're okay. You have prepared in this life, you're okay. You haven't prepared, you are in deep doo-doo. It's a big problem. There's not much you can do about it at that point. And if you get too close to the time of death before thinking about it, you may not be able to do all the Dharma training, although I wouldn't let that you stop you. If you feel like you're going to die in a week, please. Actually, there are wonderful stories about a story about a guy who was 100. He just said, I have to practice the Dharma. I'm 100 years old. I really have to practice the Dharma. And he went to this spiritual master who said, but you're 100 years old. You haven't got time. I said, I know. So the master gave him, well, I think I have this Dharma that will help you. He gave him an empowerment. He practiced it for a week and then saw the deity face to face. So even if you are 100, you still got time. but it's a little bit harder. So the more, and since we don't know if we're going to get to 100, we really can't put it off. When we talk about impermanence, Rinpoche actually recently, he hasn't come to Maine for a few years, and not all of you are able to get to Vancouver or Asia to see him or hear him teach. He's been a bit more insistent in his Dharma teaching now than he was before he got ill 3 years ago. Before he was ill 3 years ago, he would frequently say, if you can practice Dharma 100%, that is wonderful. It is very good. If you can only practice 50%, that is wonderful. It is very good. If you can only practice 1%, to cut it short, then it is wonderful. It is very good. And there is a good reason for why Rinpoche said this, because it encourages people to do even a little bit. So even if you only do a little bit of Dharma in this lifetime, it will have a beneficial result in the future. you've got to, so this is taking a very, very long view of things, because that one little bit of dharma that you do now in this lifetime is going to bring a result. But the question is, how long are you willing to wait? So Rinpoche doesn't speak like that. I haven't heard Rinpoche say that since he got sick. And instead, he just talked a lot more about impermanence, contemplating the sufferings of this life. And so I think it's important for us as Rinpoche students to also take this to heart. In fact, Rinpoche told me to do it this year. I'm starting over. I'm starting from the beginning. It's wonderful. I don't want to do any advanced practices. I just want to do these simple practices for the time being. I spent much of this year contemplating impermanence as my daily practice. Such as my daily practice is, it's not what you'd think. I'm too busy. But when I did manage to actually fit my daily practice into my daily routine, meditating on impermanence. And what Rinpoche explained is that you take the situations of your life, like we have elderly parents. And so you just think about your parents. How are they now? What were they like before? What are they able to do now? So you actually, you know, it's not thinking about something. It's, Rinpoche always gives the quotation from Milarepa, I take all that appears and exists as a text. I've never studied texts innate. You don't need to read Dharma books to know about impermanence, but you have to look. And you just have to look at the experience of your life. So you take a look at your aging parents. How are they now? How were they a year ago? How were they 10 years ago? How do you remember them when you were a child? Just sort of look. This is my father. He used to be pretty strong. And now, what is he like? So you think about this. And you look at, you know, your parent who's in a nursing home or in a hospital. Sick. What were they like before? What are they now? And then you think, this is going to happen to me unless I die first. Unless you experience sudden death, we're all going to undergo the same process as our aging parents are going through now or have been through. And so it's a little depressing. Rinpoche always admits that meditating upon impermanence is depressing. But it's sort of like Geshe Langri Tampa. I have meditated a bit. In some ways it's depressing. It's actually not as depressing as you think it's going to be. And so it's worth it to actually talk about it. When you do the Tonglen meditation, first train in the preliminaries. First think about impermanence for a few minutes. The important thing about this is that we talk about Dharma, we discuss Dharma, we do a bit of meditation practice, but most of us never really take it to the point where it's really going to bring us benefit at the time of death. Have I, looking at myself, have I got to the point where I feel like at the time of death I am going to be able to make it on my own? No. Rinpoche, Karmapa, please, your holiness. Without them, I'm sunk. And so, where are we at? And what is the main reason that we haven't done it? It's because we haven't really thought about impermanence enough to really motivate ourselves to really take it to heart. And so, that is the main thing. Now, of course, you might be you might get really depressed. It is possible. I mean, if you have a tendency to get really discouraged and depressed about things, this might not be the best meditation for you. Instead, you should think about the precious human life, which is actually sort of the same thing from a different angle. We've got a great opportunity now. So if you meditate upon the amazing fact that we have this opportunity and we don't know how long it's going to last, that's impermanence, isn't it? If we think about that, then, you know, it's actually kind of uplifting. It's like, whoa, what can I do? You can think about, you know, there's, if you think about, like, Milarepa, why was it that Milarepa was able to become a Buddha in one lifetime? You could say, oh, it's because he spent years meditating in the mountains. Well, that was later. I mean, he first really took impermanence to heart. He really took the suffering of samsara to heart. He really thought about the defects of samsara. He thought about what was going to happen to me when I die. I've killed over 30 people. What's going to happen to me? It isn't going to be good. And so, really taking that to heart, Milarepa was then able to go to Marpa and receive the instructions. And Marpa was pretty harsh on him, but because he had really taken impermanence to heart. And then after he left Marpa, before he went and spent years and years in the mountains, he went back to his homeland and saw his mother's bones. The house that he had grown up in, fallen apart, fallen down. Nothing left. The fields were overgrown with weeds. Like, everything is impermanent. Everything is changing. And then he sat there and he meditated on impermanence. He sat looking at his mother's bones, meditating on impermanence for like a week or something before he went on to have them made into relics and relic pills and stuff. So, because of that motivation, then Milarepa was able to go to the mountains and really focus on achieving Buddhahood. So we don't have such fire, and a lot of that's because we haven't thought about the suffering of our situation. But we haven't had it as bad as Milarepa, is one thing. And our lives are pretty comfortable. You know, there is an Arabica coffee here in Portland, and there are lots of other comfortable things. There's a Trader Joe's, too, where you can get yourself the wasabi mayonnaise if you'd like and enjoy it. Yes, my sister says it's very good. I have not had any. But, you know, you can get all sorts of things. You want something to distract you, you can get it. And it'll keep you amused for a little while. Until the credit card bill comes. Or maybe even a little bit longer. I don't know. But a lot of it, you know, we occupy ourselves with a lot of things instead of doing what really is going to be beneficial. And maybe it's we can keep doing the other things if we have an idea of what's beneficial all the time. And the only way we can have that is by really taking it seriously now. So that is, you know, impermanence. I just want to, I have to check my clock. Oh, okay, I've got time. I've got a little bit more time. I wanted to spend a few minutes, because actually what happens is I say, oh, yes, the teacher says, yes, you should meditate upon an impermanence. And we actually never do. So we're going to do it now, if you don't mind. So what I'd like you to do... Oh, no, it's okay. Oh, actually, no, it'd be nice. Yeah, let's do it. I was going to have my iPhone make a noise, but this is better. Okay. So what I'd like to ask you to do is... first we'll do a bit of shamatha meditation just to clear our minds, do just 21 breaths. And then after you do that, think of, depending upon your own personal situation, it could be, for a lot of us, it's our parents, it might be a friend, it might have been a grandparent, someone you know who is in those end stages of life. Maybe they're in a hospital, or if maybe you visited a friend who's not old but was in the hospital with a serious illness. Oh, this is what I do. You have no idea when you will die. And then it says tap to snooze. No, seriously, I made myself reminders on my iPhone. In Nepal, they go off in the morning. Here, they go off at 8 at night. And so it says, remember from your heart that death is certain. Tap to snooze. I didn't add that. Apple added that for me. So think of that person and just look at their situation now. Or maybe it's someone who recently passed away. You could remember them before. Or maybe not that recent, but someone who you knew was close to. Think about how they were. How they are or were at that point of illness. And then think about how they were before. What were they like before? Then just sort of think back and forth about these two. So we will do this for about about 8 or 9 minutes. So now please think of your loved one. Picture them. Sometimes it's helpful to think about the details of their appearance. Like, what is their skin like? What was it like before? also think about how this will happen to you as well, unless you die first. There are things that we want in this life. We have to think about how much benefit are there going to actually be at that time when we're old? Or how much time benefit are there going to be at the time? You know, forget about the moment of death. You know, when you're in the nursing home, they're not going to help you much at all. You can have a nice car, driver's license, gets revoked because you're too old. Your family's delighted that it's been revoked. And that nice car, you have to lend it to your son. You can't drive it to yourself. So, you know, that's how it goes. You know, so you may really like that car, but you can't drive anymore. Forget about driving. You can't even get yourself in the passenger seat, let alone the driver's seat. So, it's just, if we constantly keep this in mind, then we really decrease the effect that our consumer, I mean, as beings in the desire realm, we operate on desire. It's basically, that's why it's called the desire realm. And in this culture in particular, we have so many things, you know, the new iPad 3 Air, whatever. It's, you know, the new this, the new that, and we want to get them the skincare product that is going to keep you looking like, you know, with like a young person forever. You know, this is a, you know, like whatever, you know, that bath oil, it's just perfect. It'll keep you rejuvenated and all that. You'll feel lovely. Well, how much good is that going to do? Yeah, I mean, of course, take care of yourselves, because we want this, you know, this body is just so fortunate to have. We want it to last for a long time. So, of course, you have to take care of your body and all that. But how seriously, how many bottles of bath oil do you need? You know, or how many cups of Arabica coffee do you really need? I don't need any. I learned my lesson not with Arabica, but with a different coffee maker, a coffee brand. At any rate, so that's the somber part of the evening. I'm not Geshe Langri Tampa. I can still smile from time to time, but you know, it is important to think about that. And I think if we don't have a real appreciation of impermanence, especially, but also the others of the four thoughts that turn the mind, it's very easy for our talk of Tonglen to be high and our practice to be self-help. So it's, you know, just important to really keep this in mind as much as you can. So we have a few minutes for discussion, unless I've depressed you all. Too terrible. Yes.
Thank you, Japan. I think I missed 4 and 5 of the Tibetan sayings and impermanence.
Mm-hmm. Shall I go through all 5? Sure. Just to make sure that you didn't miss number 2 and thought it was number 3.
Okay.
Number 1, reflect that nothing lasts, everything changes.
Mm.
2 is contemplate the many others who have died. 3 is contemplate the many causes of death again and again. 4 is to contemplate what will happen at the time of death. And 5th is to contemplate what happens after death. So those are the 5 Kadampa meditations. Yes.
I thought the 2 words, renunciation and emancipation, were particularly interesting. It seems to me that so often in this culture, we approach things from a cup half empty perspective,
uh-huh.
and calling it renunciation and looking at it as emancipation seems so much more optimistic to me. Sort of cup half full.
Yeah, it's the wish for emancipation. And it's
it's like going forward.
Going forward, yes. And that's why, you know, I'm saying wish for emancipation instead of just renunciation. You know, we have this, I think Geshe Langri Tampa has not helped our image, you know, this people, you say renunciation, and people think of flagellants from the 13th century walking on their knees, you know, no more coffee. Well, I will use coffee as an example of desires frequently. It's my favorite example because I can't drink it myself. The, you know, it really is. We have to look on it. There's something else that we have our focus on, not just, it's like we want to get away from this suffering of samsara. Well, what do we want to go toward? We want to go toward that emancipation. So it's not all as, in other words, it's not all as depressing as we've made it out to be.
Just in contemplating like family members who've passed and friends who've passed, there's just that really strong desire that that not have happened, you know? It's interesting.
Yeah.
It's part of the desire. It's just we don't want... I guess it kind of boils down maybe to control or something, whether it's something we want, and we want the extra cup of coffee, or we don't want it to happen. We want them to stay forever 30. It's
yeah,
kind
well,
of the same energy.
Yeah, well, you know, it's like... It really is. You have to look. Well, what could you have? What could Ashley have done to change it? That's the point where the contemplation starts getting interesting. It's like, okay, you know, I don't want my father to be in the nursing home, but he is. And what's that? What's gonna? You know, what could I have done to change that? What could anyone have done to change that? You know. A year ago, my father was in the hospital for a month with an infected elbow. And then he got out. He had a knee replacement operation. He was up and walking around. I was thinking, oh, I'm going to come back and visit my father. He's going to be walking around. We'll be able to do something that he'll think is fun. Mm-hmm. And maybe it'll be kind of enjoyable, actually. It will be kind of enjoyable. No, he's in a nursing home. Fell and broke his hip. Not much to do about it. I mean, to change the actual situation, of course, there are things that I can maybe do to help a little bit. And he's doing the things to, you know, hopefully he'll do the rehab and maybe get better somewhat. But what can we do? The loved ones, it happens. There's nothing we can do to stop it. And there's nothing we'll be able to do to stop it for ourselves. We can sort of prolong things and, you know, sort of make things a little bit better. But at some point, it's going to catch up to us. Yes.
You had mentioned spending a lot of time contemplating the four thoughts that turn your mind to the Dharma, and you walked us through the one on impermanence, which was great.
Yeah.
Is there one for or a similar method for precious human body?
Yeah. Well, you can, if you look at the, like there's the wonderful descriptions in the Padma Rinpoche, and also a good one in the Jhampan Controller, you can read those. But you can also just sort of look. You know, we've got, here we are, we've got something that we can do, meditation practice, Buddhist practice and study. We can do this and we can see the benefits on a small level that our limited practice is giving us. And then we can look at people, other people, do they have these resources? Now, there are other resources, and there are other spiritual traditions that bring a lot of people a great benefit, but do most people around you have access to those? You know, your neighbors, the people around. If you look at the people who are rushing off to their jobs and trying to make ends meet, who are dirt poor and suffering, you know, that's one way. You can look at the people who are wealthy and so fixated upon their jobs and their careers and their boats that they don't have any time to do anything to benefit themselves. And so when they get into the situation in the future, what are they going to have? Not much. You know, so you can, it's the same thing. Look at the situation around you. And then you can also, of course, look at animals. See their suffering. What can they do about it? Yes.
And so precious human birth doesn't simply mean being born human.
No.
It means being born human and having the opportunity to practice the Dharma.
Yes.
And one contemplation that has helped me is, in terms of simply being lucky, is to remember even when I was in college, there were no Dharma books available but
mm-hmm.
for perhaps Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind,
yeah.
which is a wonderful book.
Mm-hmm.
But beyond that, there wasn't much there in terms of access to the Dharma. And then suddenly, 10 years later, that changed radically and
yeah.
continues to just be exponential. So I guess what I'm trying to say is that born 20 years earlier, 50 years earlier, I would have missed my chance.
Mm-hmm. Yes, that is, that's very true. This is something that Rinpoche also often speaks about. You can also think about it in terms of geography. We were born in, well, you were born where you were born, but you made it here somehow. And most of us were probably born in the United States, if not all of us. Well, what if you had been born in Iraq? You know, that's for the one that's currently in the hot spot in the news. You wouldn't have much chance to practice the Dharma. If you were in the Ukraine, you would have the opportunity nowadays. But if you were born in the Ukraine 12, you know, before, you would be here. So, you know, thinking about the places in the world where you could have, you know, many of the places in the world, there's just no opportunity to practice the Dharma. So you can think about it in terms of time, and you can think about it in terms of place. In the texts, they talk about the 8 leisures and the 10 resources that allow us to practice the Dharma. But basically, it comes down to the fact that we have the opportunity and the inclination to practice the Dharma, and that is extremely rare.
You mentioned luck and the word and lucky a couple of times. Does that come up as a, is there a, in Tibetan Buddhist teaching, is there, does the word luck come up, or is it about the fruition of karma?
Well,
or is it the same thing?
I'm saying lucky now. I mean, just think, well, in Tibetan, for that use, they would probably say kalden, or fortunate, kalbasampo. You know, in English, we'll say lucky. It really doesn't have anything to do with luck, and they'll stress that over and over again. It has a lot to do with the karma from the past, which in a sense is a little bit of luck for us now, because we haven't got any control over that anymore. But we do have control over the karma for the future. And so that's the third contemplation, the karmic cause and effect. But yeah, no, it doesn't have anything to do with luck, really.
It's just not a word. We don't use that word very often, that's all.
But we are lucky.
Yeah, well, I agree. I mean, I'm just...
I need to think about it.
That's
maybe I'm just being too colloquial. I should say fortunate.
All right, okay.
Yes.
So I wanted to go back, because you were talking about fitting in your daily practice.
Yeah.
Busy schedule.
Oh, yeah.
And what I found is, you know, when I have, you know, summers off, or I have a lot more time basically in summer, and naturally my daily practice just expands during that time, which I'm very happy for, and I can see because I kind of keep track of the stuff, and then I do get busy and I want to keep doing it, but then see I have this mind where, you know, if you do too much, or if one does too much, or if I do too much, I have some sort of weird backlash thing, and so I have to constantly sort of be gentle with myself in order to accomplish the types of things I need to accomplish. At the same time, I'm like, there's just always this sort of pushing and pulling with that, of like wanting to sort of ask a little bit more of myself, but not too much, but then I do my thing, which is somehow I don't know. But do you have this, and do you have suggestions for this?
Yeah. Try not to turn on the computer before 7 a.m. On the times when I've had to turn on the computer before 7 a.m., that has really been detrimental to the daily practice. But sometimes you just haven't got a choice. I think for me, what's really helped is to have a commitment. I'm going to at least do these things. And I know I've got a short version I can do, very short. It's 5 minutes. I can get through everything if I go fast enough in 5 minutes. Okay. Have I really done the practice? Maybe not. But, you know. So there are certain things that I make sure that I do every day. And there have been times where I've gotten up after having gone to bed. And, you know, I've gone to bed and thought, oh, no. There's that one I didn't do. So you get up and do it, you know. But if you try to avoid that, most often the busy days, there's a little bit of time in there, and it's a question of giving the priority to the practice. For me, since what I'm doing is basically Dharma related, there's a tendency to say, well, I'm doing Dharma anyways. But it's not quite the same. And when what you're doing, if you have summers off, maybe you're a school teacher, and so, oh, what I'm doing is sort of Dharma because I'm helping people. Actually, that is Dharma. That's the essence of Dharma. bringing that consciousness into what you do is good. But if you're doing a contemplation like impermanence with school teachers, these are my students now, and look at them, you know, 5 years later, they're huge. What happened to them? You know, so that's a contemplation of impermanence. And, you know, looking at children, it's not easy to be a child. If you look what a child goes through in order to get bigger, that is the suffering of impermanence. You go from a point of not knowing anything, not knowing that there's something more, then realizing that there's something more that you could do, but not being able to do it yet. And then you have to learn how to do it. And that's a lot of effort and work and difficulty and hard for children. And so you can see that in the course of this. When you think about mind training, the children in your classroom are, you know, they're all Buddhas. They don't know it yet. We don't really know it ourselves. But, you know, they've all got that potential. And what can you do, since proselytizing, A, doesn't work, and B, is not allowed in most classrooms, what can we do to help these children, you know, really develop in a spiritual way as well as that? And that's actually Dharma. So bringing that aspect of your practice into what you do is also very helpful. But it can be very hard. And when the workday gets to be over 13 hours, then, you know, it's hard to do anything else. And it gets to be over $10, 10 hours, it's kind of hard too. But a little bit easier. So the way it works best, if you are, what I find for myself actually is it really comes down to whether I've developed a routine. And I've got a routine that I'd like to do, but it keeps on getting upset every time I travel someplace. And, you know, I travel someplace and my routine gets thrown off for 3 or 4 days, and if I'm only staying in any place for 2 nights, then my routine is constantly thrown off. So if you're staying someplace where you have a routine, you can make sure to include that bit of whatever your practice is. And I'm using the impermanence now, just as whether it be Tonglen or Shamatha or whatever you are doing, you can fit it into your daily, find some way it works in your daily practice and then keep to it. But it takes a lot of, it's harder than you think. I mean, you would think as a monk that it would be easy for me to have a daily practice, but it's not. I look like I should. I look like I should be spending hours a day. But no, sorry. I should be, but I'm not. Yeah, Steve.
Thank you for bringing the urgency of practice into such a kind of vivid light. I was wondering if I could ask you a somewhat related question about the special preliminaries.
Mm-hmm.
A few weeks ago, we were talking in our one of our groups here about, you know, the difficulty of completing Lundro, you know, and having time to really practice it. And none of us have done the shortened Nundro that His Holiness introduced, and I know that you have been, you know, very involved in His Holiness's work, and that in particular, I think you have some firsthand knowledge of, and I was wondering if you could tell us a little bit about it, because it is a more workable way to do the special preliminaries.
To describe the situation a little bit more detail, the traditional Lundro is written by the ninth Karmapa. In his colophon, at the end of the text, he said, he didn't say the original. Actually, he compiled it from basically what lamas would tell people to do. A bunch of other prayers taken and put together, a few little things written here and there. But he compiled it, and if you speak Tibetan, it's not a big deal to get through it. But if you don't speak Tibetan, it can be difficult. And so His Holiness condensed the Lundro. You still have to do 100,000 of the refuge and refuge in prostrations or refuge in bodhicitta and so forth in Vajrasattva, you still have to recite as many of the mantras. But what it cuts down is the recitations in Tibetan that a lot of people find difficult and off-putting. Especially, it's not like you can, if you don't know Tibetan, you can do okay, we're done, but you aren't. And so that's why His Holiness wrote a short version. And what it, the part that it helps with is the feeling that, you know, there's so much other stuff that I have to read before I get down to actually doing the prostrations and so forth. It's fine to do it. You need to get the reading transmission for it if you'd like to do it. But that can be arranged. If any of you need it, let me know. We can arrange it tomorrow afternoon if you want. But you have to tell me tonight because I need to bring the text. But the larger question with the Ngundo practices is that we have this conception that, you know, Ngundo takes years to finish. And this is an idea. In the retreat, they do, as I said, you know, they do the four ordinary foundations for a week each, and then they do prostrations for 6 weeks. Some of them finish in four. Then you do a month of Vajrasattva, a month of mandala, and 6 weeks of guru yoga. So you finish the entire Ngundo practice in 6 months. Now, what this, we can say, how do they do this? But what it means is when you talk to the monks and nuns about Ngundo practice, they're like, oh yeah, I did two, I did three. And for them, 100,000 prostrations is not a big deal. It's like, they just do it. Yeah, you get up, you start, you don't worry about it. So, 4,000 a day, 5,000 a day. Some of them do six. Tulku Dhamtru, when he was in retreat, did 6,000 a day. And so part of it is we think, this is really difficult. It's going to take a long time. Because we have that thought, it does take a long time. They think it's going to be easy. Yeah, prostrations. Now, in one of the retreats, Kenpo Tashi was in the retreat. It took him longer because he was 10 years older. So that is another factor. Mm-hmm. When you're starting Ngundo at the age of, if I were to do it now, I did it when I was in my 30s, and if I were to do it now in my 40s, it would probably be a little bit more difficult. But, you know, you can still do it. We're also doing it in the context of daily life. But when I was in Shedra, a friend of mine, his mother was completely, uneducated. She'd come out of Tibet. She had nothing to do, so she decided she was going to do the Ngundo practice. She was in her late 40s, very overweight, bad knees. And so I spoke to her after she'd started. How are you doing? What's going on? I'm really slow about about the prostrations. I just can't do as many. I can only do 1,200 every morning. So now, where does this, part of it is thinking that we can do it. And for those of us, I think for most of us, there's not a whole lot that's actually stopping us. There are physical reasons that maybe we can't do 4,000 a day, but if we were to devote ourselves to it, we could probably do quite a few more a day than we think. So there's, first of all, that's the idea, it's going to be hard, and because we think it's going to be hard, we have a lot of difficulty. The other thing comes down to us not having a real solid foundation in the ordinary preliminaries. Because we don't have that fire. I mean, if we had that fire, Milarepa was willing to put up with anything that Marpa did to him in order to get the instructions. The story of what Milarepa went through is just, most of you have, I'm sure, read it. If you haven't, it's a good read. The Penguin Classics edition is a very nice edition of it now. It's came out a couple of years ago. But what got Milarepa through it was his conviction and his sense of urgency. And we don't have that sense of urgency. We may not be able to develop that sense of urgency. So that's the other thing. And then the third thing is basically what you were just talking about. How do we develop a daily practice? Well, when I was doing my prostrations, I had a very fortunate setup. I was able to spend enough time. I could do 300 prostrations a day. And as a result, I was able to finish. Well, I injured myself. But so it took a little longer. It took a little over a year. And doing it 300 a day, which is not that much, really. You know, it's like you do it in place of your workout. You don't go to the gym, you do your prostrations. And if you do that, you know, so that way, in the context of our lives, where we're not doing it, and, you know, doing it in 6 months assumes that you're going to be doing it from 5 in the morning until 9 at night. So assuming that we're going to be doing this in the context of working, then doing 300 a day and being really devoted to it, and then doing a little bit every day, because there will be days when you can't manage to do the whole thing. So doing, like, making sure you at least do 100, or if you can't do that, at least 21, but doing it every day. So the shortened Ngundro, the visualization is slightly different than in the Wantuk Dorje. It's based on a slightly different source. The meaning is really the same, but the instructions are a little bit different. So it'd be good to have someone give those instructions for you as well if you want to do the short Ngundro. But you can also read them in the book Ngundro for a Current Day.
To go, we're about 10 minutes over. But if no one needs to go, we could keep going.
Whatever. If you have more questions, if not, we'll be seeing each other tomorrow morning as well. Does anyone have any more questions? Tonight was the depressing night. So. So. What are they? What are they?
Last two pages.
Oh, yeah. Oh, God.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.